This is The Conversation. I am Michael Shaw. That is Let All Mortal Flesh, a custom-made adaptation of a hymn from Dave Muller, who I will be speaking with in a moment. And you can hear a psycho, blow-your-ears-out version of this hymn at the very end of The Conversation. This is the milder one. So, a couple pieces of business real quick before we get to that conversation. This show does need your support. It needs an angel, etc. If you are an angel or if you know one, have them get in touch. You can support the show in the meantime by going to theconversationartistpodcast.podomatic.com and donate there. You can also support in spirit by liking The Conversation, becoming a fan on Facebook, which does help visibility. I keep saying that, but it's true. You can also follow on Twitter. You can submit comments, questions, support, advice, etc. via email, theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com. And I think that's about it. Let All Mortal Flesh continues, and then The Conversation with Dave. 3-day weekend in 73 minutes. Thank you very much for listening, and I will talk to you soon.
So that interview or conversation that you had with that woman for W in New York, do you remember that? It's a woman who hosts a music show, and she had you on. You guys were chatting.
For WFMU.
Is that that you have done much of in the past?
I did college radio for a long time. Before I started doing any art, I was going to UC Davis as an undergraduate in the engineering department. In the chemical engineering department.
Wow.
And was doing, you know, all the basic, like, sort of chemical engineering the early things you do for the first couple of years. And after I started there, I started working at KDVS, the college radio station. So you start off doing, like, a 3 to 6 in the morning radio show. And I remember doing 3 to 6 in the morning radio shows and then going to, like, a 6 or 8 o'clock in the morning physics class and trying to stay awake. It wasn't easy.
Yeah. That was just you paying your dues.
Yeah, you start off low on the totem pole and work your way up.
Right.
But within a year there, within about a year and a half, I was their music director.
Wow. But let's go back to the chemical.
Yeah, chemical engineering.
Were you a big science guy in high school?
Yeah, big science guy in high school.
Right.
Did all that and then decided I'd go off to engineering, and I went to do electrical engineering at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. Didn't like the school all that much. And had got into Davis before, and I sort of snuck in the back door at Davis mid-year, which they usually didn't go for, but I had been recruited by both the football coach and the wrestling coach. And so
you were a football player and a wrestler.
Yeah.
Does the science come from either of your parents?
My dad's a psychiatrist, so I'd say, yeah, there's some level of that. I mean, they're both whatever.
But you're a very.
They both endowed me. They both endowed me with a certain amount of brain power.
You have a very left brain, I would presume too.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what I have. Really don't.
Well, it's interesting though.
I mean, it seemed like the way. Like, I never considered anything art wise until I was in my early 20s.
Yeah, and that was something that you talked about with that woman. That's mm-hmm. where I heard that. Mm-hmm. But the music. Was that something
that was sort of like a gateway.
Hardcore?
Yeah, that was from the age of like 6.
Okay.
I mean, I was borrowing their old records and listening to like a portable phonograph record player.
Right.
You know, literally at the age of 6 or 7 when we at that point we were living in San Francisco. And you know, mostly folk rock stuff, and then like sort of like one of those rock and roll is here to stay sort of, you know, compilations that has all sorts of stuff on it, and no one else was that interested in that stuff. I mean, even I have two brothers who are younger than I am. Neither of them are anywhere near as interested in any of that. And that grew into being like sort of, you know, starting to buy my own records, and then also having my own stereo system by the time I was like 12 or 13, by 13 or 14, I guess. And then you know, recording things off the radio and making my own sort of tapes to listen to off of the pop radio that I was listening to at the time. And, you know, literally sitting there with my finger on the, you know, on the record button, you know,
right.
Trying to, and then backing it up a bit, and then, you know, like, putting the next, you know, making something out of it.
Were you going between different genres even then, or were you more
I think, honestly,
at that
time? At that point it was mostly popular stuff. It was mostly, you know, just your almost not really top 40, but more like adult contemporary easy, you know, like I wouldn't say easy listening, but like sort of like top 100 things and some other older things.
Did the Beatles not make a sort of, you know, become the big focus?
No,
until
they
later?
They were earlier than that because that's what my parents were listening to.
No, but
so
I,
the Beatles in terms of my what I
in
was
in terms of your passion, yeah.
In my passion, it was already sort of like those weren't records that were I was allowed to listen to on my own because I probably would screw them up.
So they were sacred to your parents.
Well, to the point of like they didn't seem whatever they gave me was more other fodder, you know, like whatever it was other stuff that was available. So, but it was, you know, I remember listening to all those through my, you know, like through osmosis with my parents. So Beatles, Stones, Steppenwolf.
Mm-hmm.
The band,
yeah,
all I remember pretty well. Greg Allman, like the Allman Brothers, I remember, you know, reasonably well, sort of showing up somehow.
But I think the subtext of my question is, mm-hmm. how did the Beatles come to factor so largely in your work?
Well, just like anything else, for an example. You know, in my high school years, junior high school and high school years, I was heavily into like a lot of hard rock, Led Zeppelin, a lot of these other things. I started going to college, realized that there was a lot of other things to be interested in, and sort of dismissed that stuff as being kind of like, you know, lame or whatever. And then, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years later, realized there's certain parts of that I really still liked. You know, in other words, just like anything else, you figure out there's certain things that are you, and there's other things that, you know, you can't really dismiss because they are you. And that being the case, you know, more and more I just realize there's certain things that are pretty eternal, and the Beatles for me are that. I mean, they strike me as being a real synthesis of artistry and commercial success,
right?
You know, like one of the better syntheses of that, even though very short-lived, you know, really like 8 years. You know, you could talk about their, I mean, that was when they were really like creating things that, you know, even like the guys when they were separate from each other couldn't really come to the same level. I mean, you know, each of them could do some things, but not to the level that was greater than some of all those parts.
It's interesting to me, though, the way that in thinking about it in terms of what you've done with them and your work, mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine the Stones, you know, serving the same purpose, you know, for example. I mean, there's something just unsurpassably iconic about...
That's true on a lot of levels, and it's true, you know, like if nothing else, just sort of in the Beatles versus the Stones, you know, like literally the way I see it,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, if you're listening to what John Lennon had said at some point, you know, it's like they kept ripping us off. We'd do this thing, we'd move this way, they would move that way, you know, for every. And so, you know, like, I'm not saying, I think the Stones are fine. I also, the best thing about the Beatles is they did, you know, they sort of did Buddy Holly in that they, you know, they crashed and burned. So there isn't like a real lame ass version of them to go like to just make everything looking, you know, in retrospect suck, you know, I mean really there isn't
right.
You know, they're sort of like the, you know, they're sort of like the, you know, the insect, the mosquito caught in resin, you know.
Yeah,
you know, it's just they don't,
sure.
They didn't, you know, like, you know, as much as that, you know, much as like, you know, they kind of come up with these weird repackaging of things and everything else all the years, you know, every year, or they come out as you know, on rock, whatever the game is, that they rock band, you know, like the Beatles version of Rock Band.
Yeah.
Whatever. I mean, you know, it seems like they're trying to screw that up, but I mean, you know, like there's still the recordings and they're very good. You know what I mean? And I am a really hard, personally, I'm very hard on recordings. I worked at a college radio station. I worked there, you know, at a point where there was really interesting things going on, but like so many of them I would get into and then I'd listen to them too much and they would lose their magic. And there are certain things that hold up and that for me the Beatles have. So
were you playing the Beatles in your DJ sets at that time?
No, I don't think I would have very
often.
You were
playing more hot stuff at the time.
Yeah, I don't think I could have. I did would do some things. Like I remember I have mixtapes from the late 80s that I made where I'd come back to liking things like some things on the White Album, like that song Julia, or Across the Universe, or certain like that. Those could make it into a mixtape. You know, maybe I'd figure out how to. The thing about a college radio station like that is that you figure everybody else is doing that kind of stuff, so you don't have to. So you could take the, you know, you could do the things that other people aren't doing. And I've always thought about that in a lot of respects about what I do, is that I don't see the point in doing things that other people are doing because, you know, I think it's more interesting to be off in different places. Like, in other words, you know, like, like I play in that Bread and Puppet band, right? You know, at Bread and Puppet Theater. And first year I was there, I play the sousaphone. But I mean, but I also play the trumpet. I mean, I play most of the brass instruments. And the reason I started with them was that this friend of ours that we were visiting kind of this, you know, like looped me in and said, you ought to play with them. And I said, that sounds cool. I'll do that in a little bit. I'll watch them a couple more times. He said, no, let's go today. And he literally grabbed me and my trumpet and we went and I played with him that night.
Was trumpet something you were playing growing up?
Yeah. I started at the age of 9.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
And then when I was in junior high school, I changed there was a lot of trumpet players. And this, you know, once again, sort of that niche was kind of covered. And I would have been, and the teacher said, well, you want to play French horn? We have a French horn here. I'll show you what to do. And I learned how to play the French horn. I learned how to play the sousaphone. I learned how to play the baritone horn, which is sort of like a, you know, like a somewhere between a, you know, like basically a trumpet and a tuba in terms of size, about halfway. And I liked a number of things. First off, I liked being sort of the bedrock of something. You know what I mean? I liked being the lower parts of something. And I eventually was in bands where I played the bass guitar. You know, same thing. I liked being sort of like the bass, the lower end of something and sort of like some kind of level of a, but I also liked the idea when in working like with Bread and Puppet, I came back to see them the next year and I thought, well, I could bring my trumpet, but the friend of mine who had looped me into it had a baritone horn, so I ended up playing the baritone horn for them because they just needed more. Like the time I saw them, they just were kind of thin, they needed some more, you know, lower end. And then the next year I just brought that, you know, I literally put that, I have a case for it, and I put the case inside some cardboard and then FedExed it there. And you know, in other words, it just seemed like that's, you know, like it's sort of like where water, you know, kind of goes, finds the path of least resistance or something. I'm interested in finding things that, you know, solve things.
Well, I wonder if that anticipates, that description anticipates my next question, mm-hmm. which is, was there a point where you wanted to do a band, be in a band, or were you in a band, as opposed to your DJ side?
Yeah, that was, there were friends of mine and I who wanted to be in a band in the, you know, the mid-80s. And so we did. We started a band in Davis and played a lot locally in Davis. Davis is a weird place. They don't have...
best outlets.
Well, yeah, they didn't even have really like a bar you could play in, that for whatever reason, particularly at that time. So people mostly played in other people's houses. And then the school itself had like a coffee house that that put on shows. And there was like... you could play out on the main, like, quad sometimes, you know, on a searing, you know, like, lunchtime. Literally, like, where, like, I remember being barefoot one time and it was hard to stand on the stage because it's like a black stage and, you know, like, you're, you know, like, just messed up.
And what were you guys playing?
Some version of independent indie rock, sort of.
And you were playing what?
I was playing bass guitar.
Okay.
So it was like two guitars, a drummer sing, you know, like,
right.
One of the guitars sang or whoever wrote whatever songs and had lyrics for it sang.
Right. I imagine it must have been pretty unusual at the time, maybe it's less so today, to be in a band and doing sort of sports, football as well.
By that time I wasn't playing anymore in college. Like I got on the wrestling team and quit within a year. I didn't like it. It was like a job. So yeah. I would say if it would have been truly, truly rare if I was still playing on the football team and then had some level of, I don't know what you'd call it, cultural consciousness that I would be doing all this other stuff.
Right.
Plus, I'd have to be like two people almost, because it's just like, you know, there's only so much time in the world.
Let me introduce you, and we can set up our environment. So okay. I'm at Dave Muller's in Pasadena,
mm-hmm.
and this is your studio that I presume was a two-car garage converted?
Yeah.
Surprisingly modest space. I guess it's mm-hmm. cozy, and you probably like that, right?
I've always been able to make a studio out of wherever I am.
Right.
And I've worked, like, a lot of times I've, you know, gone different places and they've allowed me to use some sort of space to use as a studio. And it's been larger than this, and that's nice. But if this got in the way of what I was doing, I would guess I would make it, you know, I would have to change things. But apparently it hasn't.
Have you mostly worked where you live, or have you had...
I've had studios. I've had studios that were not where I lived. And honestly, if I had some other way of doing things, I would be, you know, like, there was one point where I had a studio in Highland Park, and we were living in Silver Lake, and more often than not, I try to figure out how I was going to make anything while, you know, in the second bedroom at Silver Lake.
Right.
You know, then I would...
Sure.
There would be really big things that I'd have to do in the studio, and it was a much bigger studio than this.
Yeah.
that I could do that with, but not really. I mean, in a weird way, I've just always been able to do whatever I need to, wherever I need to, generally, and if I need more space, I figure out how to do it. You know, who knows, one of these days I might come up with something that would require more space, and then I might just figure out how to rent something, you know, temporarily to do it, and then come back.
It's really nice, this area. It's I guess it's kind of pretty close to the border of Altadena.
Yeah, it's about three streets up.
Right, and you're basically in the foothills, I guess, mountains.
Yeah,
pretty idyllic. How long have you been in Pasadena?
We moved here in 2007, beginning of 2007, so about 5 years.
And what brought you?
What brought us here?
Yeah, what was the decision to come to Pasadena?
We lived in Highland Park in a house where I had a smaller studio that was like basically the basement of that basement in the garage of that studio or that house. And it was a, what was it? It was like, it was a three bedroom house, but they were very small, and we started having a larger family. That combined with the fact that I was making a certain amount of more money in the art world just meant we started looking for a bigger house. We were looking in Altadena, and this came up, and it was reasonably expensive as far as I think houses should be, but it really was nice, and we felt flush.
So you were attracted to sort of being a little bit more outside and what have you?
Outside in terms of outside of the perimeter of Los Angeles or outside?
More suburban, you know, more quiet, more away from things.
Yeah, where I was living in Highland Park was a little noisier, mostly with helicopters and things, and you know, a lot of neighbor noise. And you know, the after we bought this house, but before we moved into it, someone was shooting, you know, bullets down the street. You know, one day at like 10 in the morning. You know, so you're kind of like,
yeah. It's probably gentrified more since then, but...
Sure it has, but, you know, right. And I could see it was just up the street from York. I could see York already starting. That was when the York had what is called the York now was another bar before that called something Hare, the Wild Hare, I think. It was somebody who had started, who had worked at Red Lion, had moved there to do that. And so that used to be a really, really crappy dive bar called the Dragon. And so you could see things were moving up, and they kind of are, but there's different ratios of like sort of tolerance and like how fast, you know, something's going to happen. You know, like if your speed's this and it's going, you know, like this is the slope that your speed is and this is the slope that is, you know, do I want to wait around another 10 years to see if something's really going to happen or not? So, you know, financially we could afford to do something like this. And honestly, back in some respects, it would have been nicer to move up into Altadena just because the building laws are much more reasonable. In terms of like, when we first moved here, I was thinking about tearing this down, starting over, you know, with something and having a friend of ours design like a nice building. But it turns out this building and the little building next door are like the exact footprint of the maximum amount of off building space that you could do. And in this area, you can't really build
Pasadena
another...
Pasadena is strict.
Yeah, and in this area particularly, you can't build another story if there's not other two-story dwellings around that are off buildings.
Right.
Which is where you would gain something here. Yeah. And so it was kind of like, you know, whatever. In other words, it would have been easier for certain things. But, you know, once again, I don't... This seems to be okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I've functioned in here for 5 years, and I've made a lot of work. I mean, you know, the way my work works anyway is I make it and then roll it up and then make more. So it's not like I'm kind of drowning in crap right now, but that's just because most of this stuff is stuff that we took out of the house to make it look like there was less stuff in the house.
Right.
I mean, there's all these boxes are just from our bedroom.
Sure. Yeah, we'll just mention that you are going to be leasing the house out for a year so that you can go be in Vermont for a year.
Right.
Yeah,
we're moving to Vermont for a year. Yeah. It is.
So I think I saw your work for the first time, if I remember right, at the Hammer about 10 years ago now, which was do you remember the name of the show?
It was called Connections.
Okay, so it was basically it was made up of invitations that were essentially fictional.
They're not fictional. I mean, they're designed to look like posters for other people's shows. And all the information is factual. I've designed it. I might have boosted the typography from like somebody's invitation card.
Right.
But they're all for factual things. They're all for things that did happen or were going to happen or were happening at the time.
And did it come out of 3-day weekend? Or is it that more of a...
A little bit of everything. I mean, I think both of 3-Day Weekend and that came out of the same sort of interest I had when I got out of graduate school, which was sort of being interested in what other people were doing and using, you know, using the way I made things to be some level of commentary about identities and the way things work. And I was just interested. It seemed to be an interesting... I suddenly got into drawing right after I got out of graduate school.
Which you weren't doing in graduate school?
No, I was doing sculpture.
Uh-huh. Of what?
Mostly like multiple object sort of things that played with pop culture one way or another.
And you started 3-Day Weekend when you were in school, correct?
I started doing something that was sort of a proto, like a prequel to 3-Day Weekend.
Which was
when I first, my second year of graduate school there, they had just finished all these studios called the Edith and Eli Broad Studios. So Edith and, you know, basically Eli Broad and his wife paid for these studios to be built on campus that were all for, basically for graduate students, just because, not all of them really, it was just for whoever was on the top of the choosing list, you know. And so I got this brand new studio that you know, like the year before I just had like kind of a studio somewhere in the building. And I, you know, like I walked in there and it's literally brand new. You could still smell the paint, you know. And I thought to myself, well, I can move all my shit here. Or I can move all my shit to my, you know, my house that I'm living at in Angelino Heights and use this for something else. And I was already a little fed up with the school's policy for how you could use their exhibition spaces. Because they had 5 exhibition spaces and you basically had to wait all night in line one night, you know, the first month of school to, like, you know, they'd say this is the date that and basically it was this weird kind of deal where everybody was kind of like on edge with each other to get like 1 week of exhibition time sometime in the year. And there were certain times that people really liked, like April, you know, because it's close to the end of school and mm-hmm. for your thesis show and all right. this stuff. But, you know, it was kind of like really creepy. It just didn't work in terms of how I thought things should be. Particularly, so I was trying to figure out some alternative to that, or like to throw some kind of, like, you know, so I just first off said I could use my studio as like an exhibition space, like an alternative one. And people did that, but they all started signing up for like a week. So it was just like a different version of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think that was that interesting, really. And so finally I just decided that I would do this thing where I'd have one day shows. And so I would literally make, you know, I put up a sign that said I'll be having one day shows. You can sign up in the, you know, there's a sign up sheet on my door. And so for about a number of weeks there were like one day, a show every day, every 24 hours. And we even did it like, we even like took it one step further and did like 24 hours of one hour shows. But the idea was a little bit, a number of things. I mean, I also, the year before that I had been, you know, I had got into school there, or I started school there, and I had met some people at, you know, parties and so on and so forth. And I remember someone saying something like, you know, I didn't even know what that person did until they did their thesis show, because everybody's studios were really closed off. And in some respects, there's some level of, you know, you want to surprise everybody, blah, blah, blah. But there's also this idea, like, I thought this was more about everybody exchanging ideas and, like, having something to talk about. Well, you don't have work to talk about. What are you going to do? And that coincided with having a studio visit, because I used to sign up for every studio visit to every visiting artist that come through, just because I figured...
Yeah, why not?
Yeah. It was available, and, you know, it's just another voice to, you know, bounce things off of. So this guy, Perry Hoberman, is having a studio visit with me, probably the first or second one he's had that... I think it was probably the first one that day, and he says, oh, I gotta go, I've got, like, another 10 people to visit today, you know. And I just thought, like, damn, that guy's gonna, like, see more work of my peers than I do, and I go to school here, you know, in one day, you know. So the next week I put up a sign that said Dave Muller will be conducting studio visits, and I had a sign up sheet just like whatever else. And some people knew who I was, some people didn't, you know. I literally had people who I walked
into. How many
into.
People were there?
Well, they filled up the whole thing. They filled
no,
up the
mean,
whole sheet.
No, I you said some people knew who you were, some people didn't. I mean, yeah. What kind of pool are we talking about total?
Oh, you know what? 40 graduate students, or 40, you know, 40 to 50.
So it's still,
you
weren't
students.
There for that long at that point.
You mean how many people knew who I was? Who knows how many people knew who I was? They probably, like, you know, 20 people knew who I was. Probably. I mean, I'd been there like a month and a half.
Oh yeah, that's what I mean. So it was fairly early.
Yeah.
Quite early. Yeah. Got it.
But it was also like kind of my way of, you know, that seemed to be more efficient in terms of seeing other people's work.
That was a real light bulb moment when he told you that. He said, I'm going to go see.
Yeah, then, and I, yeah, that combined with my dissatisfaction sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. And it's kind of like you're going to, yeah, I mean, whatever, you know, that the cliche is you're thinking outside of the box, right? But, you know.
It was a real proactive move.
It was, but, you know, I was doing the same thing when I was going to Davis. I was the music director of the radio station, and I had a house that other bands had played at, and I started getting bands to play at that house that were, you know, like bands like the Meat Puppets or Camper Van Beethoven.
How did you get, were those guys passing through?
In that case, how did that work? In that case, I had been trying to get them to be in a show at the coffee house, and the director of concerts was kind of a jerk, and had set this whole thing up, you know, for them to do a show, and then kind of canceled late in the game. And so I said, screw it, you guys play at my house. And they did. And then they played later at the, you know, they played another
show. Did you record
later.
Them?
I did, but I didn't record them at my house. Someone else did. And I recorded them. I have a reel-to-reel tape of them playing at the coffee house. Like
all these bands?
Not all of them, but some.
Okay.
Thin White Rope, I have a terrible cassette recording of the Meat Puppets playing that's overdriven. Mostly what you get to hear is the stage banter, and then the rest of it's going, but I've listened to it. I have photographs of some of them. But anyway, so I was doing it, like, that seemed efficient too, because I knew this, I had this place.
Right.
You know, no one else is doing this. You know, like, so I realized I was sort of doing the same thing again, and even with doing the one-day shows and all that stuff, and doing three-day weekend, I was still doing the same thing again, which is, it's efficient, you know what I mean? It's like, there's some level of, you know, there is a certain level of work involved, but, like, the payoff is really, you know, interesting to me. So yeah, it didn't seem, you know, like I guess a lot, you know, like as it seems efficient to me anyway. That, you know, granted there's a certain amount of whatever, doing anything it requires work, you know, generally. It's nice if it doesn't seem like it does, but that worked for me in all those cases because it just seemed efficient. You know, all I had to do, say for, you know, basically go visiting all these studios was to take a day of my time and put up a sign, you know, talk to some people about it ahead of time, sort of, and just did it. And that seemed more interesting to me in the long run, that seemed more interesting to me than some of the things I was doing otherwise. You know, I mean, making sculptures of some sort or another.
Right, right. Well, how did then, without skipping over a three-day weekend mm-hmm. for a moment, how did it, I mean, that is partly a graduate school culture, or a product of graduate school culture to some extent, in that context. Mm-hmm. So
how do you
that you're in this very different space, you know, working alone in your studio, you know what I mean?
Well,
what are some of the throughways that connect those two things, if anything?
At some point when I was going to school, I still was thinking of some level of identity and how an identity gets constructed one way or another. And I was mostly because I was interested in other people's identities. And I guess particularly at the beginning when I got out of school, I was interested in other artistic identities and how they got portrayed and how it would be interesting to portray them in different ways or in alternative ways. Because I kind of felt like most criticism is kind of like reportage, particularly for like reviews of shows, things like that. There isn't a lot of analysis. And there is only certain kinds of analysis, I thought, and maybe not certain ones that were just based on sort of gut feelings and other things that I thought were interesting to explore in the kind of work that I could do. And that's what became kind of this work that looks like it's posters for other people's work, which is kind of awkward to say. But it
didn't sound awkward.
Well, it's because I've been saying it a lot. But, I mean, because a lot of people say they're the invitations or the announcements works, and they always think they're just copies of something. Like, it's sort of like an appropriation. Whereas what I'm appropriating is something else, like somebody's identity or appropriating a look that makes it seem like it could already exist. They don't exist that way.
Well, I think what the underlying heat of what you're talking about came mm-hmm. across to me, for sure.
Right.
And, you know, they were very charming and, you know.
I also thought they did well when they were in, you know, like in numbers. Like, I thought that worked even better.
A lot of breath. Yeah. What, had you already been doing music-related imagery by that point, or did that come a little later?
The closest it got to music-related, there would be some things I thought about like music. There were a lot of things that I worked in series that would be almost like, you know, like sort of like minimal music, or I thought about things in musical, you know, like from in musical metaphors, at least in my head. There was a lot of things that had to do with, say, you know, like there would be ones that were sort of like ambient music. There would be ones that, you know, the way they looked, I had musical thoughts about them. And I also used a lot of the language of music in the titling.
Was the genesis of music related? I don't know if I'm trying to skip ahead too fast here, but I'm just curious what the genesis was when you started making music related objects like the albums and what.
Well, I started trying to make drawings of my collection one way or another, and I figured out different ways to do that, and most of that was sort of about how, you know, any collection is sort of, you know, like you are what you eat, you know, kind of situation. So
yeah.
Any collection is indicative in some way, shape, or form of the collector, you know, you can, if they're all, I use this a lot, but it's like they're all sort of, you know, if you're thinking about vectors, you know, being a guy who studied science, vectors are basically like some kind of quantifiable thing pointed in some quantifiable direction. If you take all those vectors and kind of point them, they kind of, you know, like put them together, they sort of make some level of a space that gets inhabited one way or another. That's how I sort of...
It sounds like you're describing your disco balls, too, at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so that being the case, like those artifacts were interesting to me somehow, and particularly the musical ones, because I kind of think music is sort of the lens about through which I see a lot of things one way or another. So I always, you know, I guess in deep down I always wanted to make things that had to do with the music part of my life, but I felt in a way I had to come up with an object or a series of objects that were as interesting as I thought the music was. And so it probably took me a long time to figure out how I could do that, if that made sense.
Well, I can't...
In other words, you know, it's kind of like... It's like a lot of things. It's very hard to make two-dimensional art about three-dimensional things or four-dimensional things. It's hard to make... You know, in other words, it's hard to figure out how to do that in a way. And it's even harder, honestly, to go the other direction and make that something that's time-based about something that's not, in a way, without sort of going through a lot of tropes. And it's hard to do something original about that, and I've thought about that a lot. But anyway, that being the case... It was hard for me to figure out how to sort of make something that could be as interesting to me as the things that sort of were my lifeblood. You know, this all this music I listened to. And I was very careful not to listen to too much things over and over again to wear them out for myself. That was what I felt had happened in the 80s when I was working as a music director, where you'd hear this, you know, music and you go, this is the greatest thing, and then you hear it too much. And it sort of burns out. So I was very careful on the things I really did care about not to overdo them in a way. I'm not like the Andy Warhol guy who like listened to, you know, She Hit Me and It Felt Like a Kiss, you know, like, you know, 50 times, you know, over and over again in the studio,
mm-hmm.
for whatever reason. And it mostly was just because I kind of liked them still being interesting. So my way around that was to deal with like a large level of diversity and a large volume. And so everything seems sort of new to me one way or another.
I don't know how much you are open to this version as well, but there's the fetishization element too.
You mean of records,
yes.
Or just in general?
Yeah, of records.
Yeah, I'm not that.
But the drawings have that, you know, quality.
They only have the quality that I try to, you know, draw them as. I'm interested. It honestly isn't that interesting to draw a series of records that aren't beaten up. Just physically, I've done it. There are people's collections. A lot of these are portraits of other people. Someone like Matthew Higgs, his records are immaculate. But then drawing them is kind of like it's harder to make that look interesting because. There's just not all this other kind of flotsam and jetsam to kind of like distract you or whatever else. And the records I own are beaten up. You know, that's the way they are. They, you know, I carry them around in crates. They get beaten up. Occasionally they get water damaged if I wasn't careful or whatever else, you know.
Well, just step outside of your work for a second and just purely on a tactile level with your records. I mean, don't you have some kind of love affair with them, or is that an exaggeration?
I have a love affair with their effect. I have a love affair with their content. I have a love affair with what they do with me, you know, for me. I don't particularly have a love affair with the actual objects in the way that I have no problem using one or another. You know, the nice thing about records is they're mass-produced, generally, which means that, you know, like, and I have lots of extra copies of things for a number of reasons. I mean, if they're cheap, I just buy them because I know if it's something I really like and I run into somebody else I know who I think might like it, I can hand them one. I don't like not having a record I really like, so if that's fetishization.
Well,
but I don't think that's particularly what you're talking about. Like, you're talking about fetishization being sort of like an overly...
I'm not putting a judgment value on it. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying when you look at these images with your records as opposed to Matthew's records, you know, mm-hmm. they have that quality when you look at it, you know, it's kind of like,
But that's just the life they've led being in this collection. You know, it's mm-hmm. like other people would take better care of their records. I consider records to be something I use, you know what I mean? It's like,
but when you're making an image of it, you know, then it kind of becomes all of those things.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. It gets used in another way, too. But, I mean, the only thing I wouldn't be thrilled about is if it was so beaten up that it's so illegible that you can't, you know, read it. And very rarely will I do that. Because I think it's important that, you know, like, it's an index. And if you can't read the index, then it's not an index anymore.
Right.
But I don't know, you know, like I like the fact that they get beaten up at different rates, you know, and I think that's interesting, but then the human body has the same issues. I mean, you know, I've got scars all over myself.
And that goes back to the you are what you eat kind of that description.
A little bit. Or you are how you abuse your food, whatever it is, you know what I mean? It's but I'm only fetishistic on the fact that I'm kind of a collector and I have to have a lot of things. You know, if I'm interested in something, I like to mine out the entire vein, you know, in a way. But I'm not, and
so you
but
have,
I'm not like I'm not like the record collector who thinks too hard about that kind of stuff. It's more about acquisition and whatever it takes to acquire something.
And how many, remind me again, how many records you have?
My guess is between 6,000 and 7,000.
Okay.
And honestly, I could probably go through and get rid of at least like, you know, a couple thousand, but at this point it's useful to me to have a lot of these different records, because if I'm doing portraits of other people, then I don't have to buy the record, you know, I already have it. You know, like in some respects, I'll be keeping records that I wouldn't listen to because other people have, you know, I've already gotten them for one reason or for another for other people. You know, I've got a lot of U2 records I don't plan on listening to for a while. I mean, maybe I will someday, but, or a lot, you know, like various other records that are very popular with people that I've used more than once.
You go more, you would be more balanced towards depth in bands than obscurity. Is that, would you say that's fair assessment?
Well, I don't know if those two things are oppositional. The thing I would think is that I'm into all sorts of different things. I'm into all sorts of different things. I try to deal with them in depth on some level within the financial range of, you know, what I can do. My level of depth, basically what I want to do is be able to hear anything somebody has done generally that when I get into them. Now, these days, that means on MP3s, I can find out a lot of things.
And what are your, have been your sources for discovering things?
Early on, probably reading magazines, and I read the NME a lot, read Music Melody Maker, whatever, mm-hmm, the English magazines,
mm-hmm,
in the early 80s, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Rolling Stone, I guess. So you do that, you listen to the radio a lot, and then when I finally got into college radio, of course, it was listening to all sorts of other people who were playing things.
Were you listening to Solicitations?
What are Solicitations?
Were you listening to some, you know, random submissions that did people send stuff in?
I guess so, but not really that much. More often than not, we knew what was coming in because there's record pools and so on and so forth. Yeah, things would come in uncalled or unasked for, but that was such a rare occasion. That was, you know, it was definitely less than 1% of what was coming in. Most of what we got was from major and independent record labels and mm-hmm. different record pools.
Right.
And then we got so much of that was, you know, like my record addiction was fueled by that too, because there'd be doubles and triples of all sorts of things that come in, and it was your job to figure out what to do with that. Some of those I would keep, and others, you know, a lot of it I would take to other record stores and trade that in for credit on buying things that we didn't have and we wouldn't get otherwise. So I did a lot of traveling around to different record stores, and there were certain ones I knew who would take a lot of things, and I would, you know, like get credit there and buy other things that the station did not have,
mm-hmm.
like older things that should have had. It was always really hard to get imports, though now it's not, you know, that whole thing has gone away, but like in the 80s, that was a hard thing to do. Like, find imports, they were expensive, and
right.
so on and so forth. They were kind of like more treasured, and you'd get those things and bring them in.
But what's been the digital source of
now
discovering, yeah, the last 5-10 years?
Blogs, reading Pitchfork every day, reading...
So are there certain individuals?
There's certain blogs. Well, there's blogs. There's blogs. The sources have become so manifold that it's almost harder to figure. There's all sorts of blogs that have MP3s on them, you know, that you can download entire albums. So a lot of that, really. And I have no issues with that. Like, in other words, about finding out new stuff. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of people that say, like, you download MP3s. You know, the record companies hate that. And, you know, they all... But you know, I've been spending more money than ever on records, so...
Right.
You know, I mean, yeah, granted, no. I never in my life did buy brand new records from record companies, you know, generally. I mean, more often than not, what I was buying anyway was, like, used records, because I always found things for cheaper than I, you know, and so
yeah.
I'm still outside of whatever this kind of economic loop that these dingbats seem to be trying to beat up the whole time.
It's anyway. Much more satisfying finding a used version of what you're looking for than
whatever. You know, like, I mean, granted, if I had to, I'd buy new, but I mean... You know, I wasn't buying things new way back when, and you know, whatever. These days, I still buy a lot of records, and you know, more than ever, and it's because I know more. There's more things for me to know about that I want to buy. So I get it from everywhere. Literally, I have, there's MP3 blogs, there's people I trade music with.
Right.
There's, you know, I don't really use any of the torrents because I've never really been that interested in that kind of world. Occasionally something is a very large like digital file for like a movie or something I might torrent, but even that, like, it's so spotty as to really whether you're going to get it or not. It doesn't interest me.
I was just also thinking DJs of, you know, whether online or on the radio, if that would be a source at all.
Not too much, because what I ended up doing was making such a large I have now about 2 terabytes of music, which, you know, if you're playing it 24/7, will last for almost 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, without repeating itself. So it's kind of like your own radio station where everything surprises you. And that's what's, you know, right over there. It's like literally playing at random, whatever. I just, you know, turn on the sound and it's playing. I turn it off, it's still going generally, unless I turn it off.
Right.
And I just have that going, and I still get surprised by all sorts of things I've downloaded and put in there that I hear that. I mean, there's just a record I bought. The record I was saying earlier, I bought some record from some guy in Cambridge, I think, that was like, I think I paid like $70 for it, that I just heard on there, but I probably downloaded it like, you know, a year or two ago. And I just put it on there because it seemed like interesting, you know, and I never probably listened to it at the time. And it came up random, and I was like, that's really good. I went, you know, I Googled it and looked up more stuff, knew exactly where I downloaded it from, which blog, because it was, you know, the first thing it came up just about, and it's reasonably obscure. And I, you know, I'm about ready to go buy some more records. So I don't really give a darn about, like, these big, big money people.
Sure.
I mean, you know, I don't know if that's a sidetrack, but it's, you know, on some levels, that's indicative of where I am with a lot of things.
No, I was thinking of, in, you know, small radio stations, you know,
yeah,
that,
but,
that
you know,
play certain things that you wouldn't.
Yeah, but that's
elsewhere.
The whole thing is, yeah, that's true, but, I mean, it's so much, you have to do that in real time, if you make it, you know, if that makes any, you know, like, you know what I mean? It's like, I can, you know, if I want to spend some time, I can download a lot of things and put them on my computer. You know, granted, I have a huge backload of things because I'm really fussy now about the kind of information that goes in with them. Like, I have to process it all before it goes into the main group. I have to process it all with, like, you know, like, real data. Like, in other words, like, you have to have track names and titles and blah, 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 all that stuff. And they're not always supplying with that. So I have to do, you know, it's a little time consuming, but I will do that, particularly when I have downtime, to put more in.
How many songs are in your library, do you think?
235,000. It's the equivalent, if you had like 10 records or 10 songs per record, it's like 23,000 records or something.
Right.
It fits on a, you know, a hard drive this big. I used to, you know, like, I traveled a lot, either working for Mike Kelly or, you know, like, traveling around doing my own work. And I used to carry up to 200 CDs in those books. And that's heavy.
Yeah.
And also, like, you know, with 200, even with 200 CDs.
Were you DJing? Is that why you carried them around?
No, just to listen
just
to.
Just for your
just
own
to, like, with a, yeah, just to listen with a pair of powered speakers and a little, you know, portable CD player. Because I just, like, I need to listen to stuff. And, you know, like, granted, you can listen to radio sometimes in different places, but you never know. And it's like, you still, you know, like, it's an addiction.
Yeah.
On some level. And, you know, I would carry that around along with everything else I was carrying around. It's heavy. And, you know, there'd always be these points where even though you have that many, you're flipping through them, you're like, there's nothing here I really want to listen to. Occasionally, and you go, oh, yeah, I haven't listened to this in a while, you know, put that on. Oh, no, that sucks. Right now, that's just terrible. You know, who knows, some other time it's going to be good, but right now it's not, you know, like, and this, you just don't have to think like that. You just,
yeah.
You know, just let it rip at random. If you don't like something, you fast forward it. You go on to the next song. I mean, there's 45-minute, hour-long BBC things on there, you know, that are just like radio plays that someone gave me. Occasionally, you know, sometimes I listen to them, sometimes I don't. Sometimes I go, that was good, let's listen to the whole thing. You know, it's like, you know, 5 acts. I'll listen to it for 4 hours while I'm working.
So you mentioned Mike Kelly.
I
would be interested to just talk about him for a minute.
Okay.
How long did you work for him?
5 years.
You didn't connect through school, did you?
No, I connected mostly in 2 different ways. First off, I was making a living building things for people. You know, like building art for being an assistant or installing work or building, you know, I was pretty, at that point I was pretty good at carpentry, so I could build things for people. And so I was doing a lot of that. And my friend Sam Durant, who had gotten out of CalArts the year before I started, who I knew socially and hung out with, was working as Mike's assistant. And Sam got a job teaching, or working at CalArts, running their shop, and then teaching there too. And he still does teach there. And Art Byington called me up and said, hey, I heard you play bass. We need a bass player for, you know, for this band that Mike's in. Would you like to try out? And I was like, sure. So it was me, Art, Ann Magnuson, and Mike Kelly were in this band.
What was the name?
Super Session. And she had already recorded a record with this guy, Richie Lee, who was in a band called Acetone. And Richie decided he had to stick with Acetone. This band had, you know, had some label interest and everything. Mm-hmm. And so they were looking for a bass player, and so I started that. And then it turned out Mike had just sort of rejuvenated the Destroy All Monsters band, because he and his friends from like Jim Shaw and this guy Kerry Lauren and Niagara had all, he had, through Thurston Moore, had decided to put out, or through with urging from Thurston Moore, decided to put out a 3-CD set of like all their old recordings that he had remastered. Or that, you know, that they had from old tapes and things. And so with that in mind, they decided they wanted to play some venues. And so I ended up being the bass player for that too. And so I had started doing that, and within a month, Sam got this other job, and Mike was asking him who he should get to replace him. He says, well, that guy's playing bass for you. You know, he's a friend of mine, he knows what he's doing. So that I ended up doing that, like, you know, within like basically about 2 months, starting playing music with that whole group, and then working as Mike's assistant and basically the guy that built everything. And if I needed more people, once again, I'd just hire more people to help me and stuff like that. And then that got bigger and bigger.
So what was it like working for him? Was it a good experience?
Great.
Yeah.
Great experience.
Did you do a lot of traveling in addition to making
work? Yes. I mean, eventually, like,
installing?
Yeah. Eventually, like, basically within when was it? Yeah. Within a year or two of working for him, some of the things we were making were so large, you know, that needed help being installed in other places. Mm. And then I would start doing that. And I was doing 3-day weekend all that time too. So then it allowed me to kind of figure out ways to do 3-day weekend in different places.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which got more, it happened more and more.
Yeah. Were you guys in touch in the last several years?
On and off. I mean, I'd see him at things. He and I had emailed back and forth about maybe getting together to play for a while. I hadn't really played with him since about 2004 with Destroy All Monsters. And then a year ago, he had this big sort of closing party for the studio he had in the, what's the name of that building? The Farley Building. The one in Eagle Rock where that show he did with Mike Smith, the big show that was at the Sculpture Center before and then was there. He was using that as a studio, and then he decided to kind of close things down a little bit a year ago, right after he did the show at Gagosi in Beverly Hills. So I hear that they're having this party that they want to DJ, so I ended up DJing this party, you know, at that big space. And we played, like, all of us played together. That would have been, like, me, Mike, Mark Lightcap, Abel McCone, both guys who work for him now, and Jim Shaw. I think Tom Watson was there for a while, like, playing. And they're just kind of screwing around, basically. And I see him, you know, see him at various events and say hi to him and talk with him a bit. I mean, we always got on well. And then I saw him the night before he killed himself, because there was this show at the Welcome Inn that was this music show that Sasis put on, and I was performing a John Cage piece in one of the hotel rooms. And he just kind of stuck his head in and said, "Hey, Dave." And that was the last time I spoke with him, or I didn't really speak with him. I just said, "Hey."
Is there any kind of takeaway maybe that you could offer as far as maybe what you learned while you were working for him?
I learned a lot about how an artist functions and what level, you know, like, sort of the most I learned from him was, I mean, it was interesting being around somebody who particularly was, who knew how he wanted to do things and could do them. And so you go, that's good, I can do that in some respects, or, you know, like, at least I can think about doing that. And I learned a lot about how to deal with institutions, you know, and what level of, you know, like, what level of give and take there might be. So those are two good things, I think. I mean, a lot of good things, really. There was all sorts of good things.
Yeah.
You know, just different models about how you might want to do something versus other things. I think there's a lot of people who are more authoritarian than he is, particularly. He didn't particularly care what you did, you know, how long you worked and did everything, as long as everything got done. You could come in when you wanted to, you know, whatever. And I appreciated that, as, you know, like, it kind of sucks to work for anybody.
Did you show him your work?
We never had that much interaction. He saw it. I mean, he saw it, and he always liked it, and he even talked about trying to purchase some at one point or another. But I don't know why, but I never formally asked him to do, like, a studio visit and talk with him.
Right.
I mean, I absorbed a lot of his just thinking through osmosis. Maybe I didn't feel like
sure.
I needed to.
Sure.
And I also, at that point, particularly, had just been out of school for a number of years, and I kind of was done with the pedantic, you know, sort of the pedantic model. On some level, like, I just figured I had to figure out a lot of things on my own, which I was.
I think this is a good segue, actually, too, because something that I meant to sort of bring up earlier was The work that you've been doing more recently, and this is, again, not to sort of make any kind of qualifying judgment, but, you know, it's, I think it's, for me anyway, it's it's fairly straightforward. Some of the work that I saw in the past, you know, maybe five, six years ago, something like that, I just remember walking into the gallery and being very disoriented. And I'm just wondering, you know, what your take on that. I mean, it's a very, it's being disoriented in a very satisfying way, because you know there's something going on that, you know, something you have to sort of come to terms with over a period of time. And I'm just, I guess the question then becomes, do you look back and can you see what I'm talking about?
Maybe. I think it's hard for me, you know, it's hard for me to be disoriented on any level because I'm, you know, being the author. Maybe I think that some things are more overtly disorienting than other things. I mean, I guess I'd always want that, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I'd always want that. I've always had things to do with some level of, you know, I still go back on this thing, but like some level of identity one way or another. If it's the place, you know, like the place, some depiction of a place, you know, or some depiction of a situation or some depiction of a, you know, a grouping of things, whatever it is, I still think it relates to something that, you know, comes back to like sort of a, you know, this group of things that relates to an identity, whether it's an identity of an institution, identity of a person, identity of some kind of artifact. And I always had this interest that, particularly in things that people don't particularly look at that hard, like I like there being something, you know, like, or something that, like, for instance, I was always really interested in this guy. This guy has a gallery in New York that now is a two-person gallery, and he, I've met him before too, so I'm having, you know, just having a senior moment. But, you know, a lot of the, he shows older things that, like, people have forgotten about. But they had careers back in the 70s, 60s. And, you know, a lot of where he figured this out was by looking through old art forms. And looking at the old ads and stuff like that. And looking through old articles and things. Like these things that, I'm interested in these things that were a big deal, or like, and then disappear. And then, you know, but these people keep making things or something. And I had always had the interest with the artwork about like the posters that look for like other people's, you know, like look like posters for other people's shows, being like, well, some of these people are famous now, some of them are more famous than I am, some of them are a lot less famous or whatever, but they all did something. And, you know, like at some, you know, like this is sort of, once again, sort of fixing it in amber, you know, in a way, like at least that name's around. Whereas some of these people, you know, there's a lot of people I went to school with that just disappeared. Or
was there a spirit of, do you think, in retrospect, of honoring your fellow students by giving them these, you know, one day shows?
No, it was more, it was much more self-serving than that. It was, I got to see what they were doing. It wasn't a level, that's the whole thing. There's an institutionalization of a lot of this stuff that I'm not interested in. It's more like a way I can access this stuff and actually see what, you know, what I was frustrated with, particularly with that, was that these people would work on all these different things, but then you would see their thesis show. And it might not have, you know, there'd be like a focus thing, like you had to kind of keep yourself tight buckled and focused for this thing. And all those other things weren't nearly as focused, but they might be just as interesting one way or another, but you wouldn't see them because there was this one thing you were going to do. This is the spotlight you had to shine on, and it was this one thing. So I was trying to show up these other areas where you could see like these interim things people did or things that were supposed to be asides or whatever else, because I thought they were just as interesting, or at least, you know, sometimes more interesting. So the same thing, that's why I try to do all that stuff. In some respects, I think that's why I made a lot of that work that looks like the posters for other people's shows. In a way, that's why I think I'm doing now. You know, it's like I'm trying to figure out a way to like pull out something, you know, from these groupings of things. And
the, well,
where that something happens now is more inside your head or something than sort of overtly, you know, like sort of exterior. And that's interesting to me. You know, like in other words, you have to confront your thoughts about like that, whether you even know what you're looking at. In terms of like a lot of the weird ones I do for my own portraits of myself, you know, I don't really care whether people know or don't know what those things are, but you could look them up, I guess. You know, like some of them are obscure, some are not. Most of the ones I do for other people that are like commissions or that are things, it's a little less obscure.
Well, there was this show, the show that I'm referring to, maybe, which I should be more specific about, is the image that I seem to remember most is the cow. I can't remember if it was wearing headphones, but that was the show, and there were more abstract images, it seemed.
Yeah, there was a lot. That was like my dealing with sort of like the most recent show I did at Blum & Poe, which was in 2009, you're speaking about?
Okay. Yeah, that sounds right.
All the whole big room was like 10 or 11 pieces that were each like 10 feet by 5 feet. And they were all arranged kind of like dominoes. And like images attracted like images. They were that, you know, I was interested in that respect of trying, like, first off, I was trying to do something, you know, sort of different than what I had been doing for a while, which is the music work. That was a sort of a short notice show on some levels because Blown Poe was supposed to have been out of that space by then, and they needed to ask. They asked a couple of artists, myself and Sam Durant, to do shows that because they couldn't move out yet, or they hadn't gotten the other space ready. I was set to do a show. I work with Barbara Gladstone, and I was set to do a show with Gladstone. I was a little trepidatious to do a show there at this new space they had. I just didn't feel like I had something to go there, and it seemed like sculpture really did well there, and I couldn't figure out something sculptural I could do. So I'm always thinking, you know, having studied sculptures, you know, since I was little, basically, you know, since I, as far as an artist is, as little, you know, since that was all I did when I first started doing it, and I'd like to figure out more sculptural ways, you know, I'd like to figure out more sculptural ways of dealing with things, but I deal with a lot of things sculpturally in terms of how things are installed and, you know, laid out and play with each other and, you know, architecturally deal with each other, which is sort of like dealing with sculpture. But I haven't been able to figure out how to make physical sculptures that much. Like, for whatever reason, I don't believe in things I can think of as much as I believe in other things I can think of.
Do you consider these iPod boxes sculptures?
You mean that? Yeah, that's a blown up version of an 8-track tape, a double 8-track. Yeah, I do.
I consider them
sculptures. Yeah, that I have. I can show you. It's right over there. Yeah. So anyway, that being the case, I said, well, I would like to. I'm also, you know, like granted, like I have been making this music stuff for a long time, and though I feel like I'm reasonably adept at it, I'm always trying to figure out new things to do. I mean, that's an artist's bread and butter, really. You know, it's, I mean, you can keep doing the things you're doing, and people will applaud you for that. But I mean, you know, figuring out new things is the best.
It's also the most challenging.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, that's your I think that's your job. And so I'm always trying to figure out different ways to do things. And I really like making, the one things I always liked about making the big, you know, the big work that's like about the music and stuff is that it starts getting to the point where it's, you know, I started making things that were bigger than you were physically, you know, so you can kind of lose yourself in them in some respects. And it's not just a window anymore. It's like a, you know, it becomes like a Gans field or something, you know, and I was really interested in fields in general, like field painting one way or another. Like, you know, like I'm a big fan of Pollock. Big fan of like anything that's kind of fieldy, James Turrell, you know, all sorts of stuff like that. And I was trying to figure out ways to deal with that, but like to do some kind of strange, you know, game with the arbitrariness of sort of the combinations of fields and see if there was any frisson that could be gotten from that. Plus the way I always think about like DJing, a lot of times I don't really think so much about what the content is as so much as how well they blend together, like the two songs hitting each other. And I always liked being able to DJ as a, you know, in radio or anywhere where I can take things from different places, but because they do some, either that, you know, they call it a segue is what you're talking about. But I mean, you know, either they blend really well together or one's jarring and the other one, you know, like is jarring or does something. And there's some things that you wouldn't imagine would go together well, but they do. And, you know, like it's.
Is that the subtext of the show, do you think?
Yeah, on a lot of levels. Yeah. On a lot of levels, and particularly that one room. I also was saying goodbye to that room, which I dealt with a couple times, and wanted to do something with it that really, like, installed, you know, like really played with the whole room. So I decided I would make these things that were sort of like dominoes in, you know, in terms of game pieces in a way, where, you know, like, every, you know, these are sort of like enough that you could sort of, you know, they'd attract each other. And then the question kind of becomes whether the social, you know, whether the subject matter is more important than the physical fact that they're, you know, in a frame with something else. In other words, are you really looking at this as a diptych, or are you looking at this as a diptych? You know, and I wanted to play that game pretty heavily, which is sort of what I do with the radio, you know, like the radio show and stuff.
Right.
And so that was where that sort of started, you know, like I'm trying to figure out disparate things that I had in my that would work as well, you know, as immersive as a field, whether it's like, you know, like this puffer fish, you know, or like, you know, a leaf, or like, you know, another mollusk or whatever, or lines, or like a line drawing, but some things that just would like somehow work that way, you know, one way or another. And that the question sort of becomes like, sort of where's the diptych, you know, is the diptych between, you know, is the diptych physical proximity? Well, those are reasonably disparate. Or is it, you know, like, sort of content affinity? And so those things were interesting to me one way or another. That's how that started. So that room, and then the other things would be other things that related or were, had to do with some level of, you know, sort of straight identity on my end. And all these images came from something I was rather interested in, whether it's my record collection, you know, line drawings, my record collection, or the cows that I'd already drawn some pictures of in Vermont, where I go over summer, or like the ground in Vermont, or the world, or...
So what did you see as the identity of the cow in Vermont? Since you gave it a very funny title.
Yeah, what's it? That was like, "Hey, Moo Cow, what's on your iPod?"
Yeah.
Well, that was kind of like, all the titles were trying to figure out how, some logic that would tie the one image to another image. So, like, in this case, it's like, and I definitely put that one, like, so you'd see it all the way down the hall.
Yeah.
I was, in, you know, thought that was important.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, well, do whatever, do androids dream of electric sheep, you know, do, you know, like, what does a cow think about? Well, the cow doesn't particularly think about music, as far as I know. But I do. I think about cows. Whatever, you know, there's some level of, like, you know, like that. Or there's, you know, that was always, there was, I think that line actually comes from, like, there's a web board called I Love Music, ILM. And they used to say that, like, there would be somebody in the news and they'd, you know, like, the posts would be about, like, say, "Hey, George Bush, what's on your iPod?" Or, "Hey, you know, hey, so-and-so," you know, someone who was in the news. And then, yeah, then there'd be song titles. Generally, there were song titles that would be jokes about, you know, like, something that had come up in the news. Like, you know, I think he had... I mean, you know, there was the whole thing, like, he did have an iPod, and there was a list of things, but also, like, I think that was right after he, like, wiped out on his mountain bike or something, you know,
right,
like, while he was, you know, while he's president. And so it's kind of like, you know, there'd be various people making jokes with titles of songs that had to do with, like, wiping out and, you know, whatever, things like that. So that's where that came from. It just came from that nugget, but I liked it as being something I could use. You know, it was like, it seemed to be a good model for what I'm talking about with, like, basically a line drawing of my record collection. And, you know, a picture of a cow underneath, you know, which, you know, anytime you look at a cow like that, you also think of Andy Warhol or whatever else. But it also, like, all those things were like fields. And, like, I mean, in other words, it almost was like, you know, there would be, it was, like, you know, like imagery that was, like, mostly, like, you know, like complicated without so much of a central image. And I was interested in sort of like that level of a dissolved central image or something, you know, like where the content's supposed to be. Whereas I'm always interested in this kind of space where, like, you know, the content's, you know, like, whatever, I'm not showing you, like, the faces of all these records. I'm showing you the, you know, where the data is that you would see, sort of, you know, which is sort of, like, less a straight-on portrait, but it strikes me as, you know, I use a metaphor. When I was in the wrestling team in high school, and I've used this, and it's, you know, I've said this before, but I like it anyway still, so I'll keep using it until I find something better. They used to teach you, when you're standing there, like, facing this guy, you don't look at his head. With a head, you can do this, you know, you can go... You know, you jerk it around, do whatever you want, so, like, you can fake someone out. You watch their hips, and where their hips are, that's where they're going. That's where they're going. You can't fake someone that well with your hips.
Right.
And I like that as a metaphor for how I want things to work in art. In other words, so many things, you know, like, that's why I want something to be a little more true to something than like, something that's kind of like a set thing. Like, you know, like, people always think a personality means your face. You know what I mean? And granted, there's a lot to be said for that. But, I mean, you know, how do actors, you know, like, then how do actors actually do that? They, you know, they figured out how to make what you can do with your face into something that makes people think something's going on. You know what I mean? You know, in other words, they install content using, you know, facial expressions and gestures and everything else. So, is that true? Well, it's as true as it needs to be, I guess, but I want something, you know, like, I want to know some other things. The way you pick up all these sort of subconscious things from people or from things or from anything... that, you know, I trust more than I almost, you know, with my instincts, more than I trust somebody, you know, like somebody could be fooling you.
So that's exactly what was going on with that show, at least in my experience of it. And so I think it's a fair question to consider, which is with, for me anyway, with the albums, you know, it's what we talked about, but there's not so much of the hip thing as there is with this
body, but I'm not that, but yeah, but that's, I'm not, I'm only... I mean, I guess I know a lot about culture, and I am aware of culture on a lot of levels, on, you know, not all levels, but that I'm not, I still think that there's other truths that might not be hip truths that I'm interested in, I guess, you know what I mean? Maybe they become hip truths later, I don't know, you know what I mean? Like, you know, like, I'm not sure if that's where I try to figure out things that are interesting enough for me to do them, and I honestly am pretty harsh. I don't like that much art that's out there, to be honest. I mean, I like people. I like some art. I don't really like that much, you know. It's hard for me to go to, like a New York, you know, go through Chelsea and see that stuff and see, like, one show I like, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's just disheartening. But, and so I'm, you know, like...
Is it disheartening for them or for you or for both?
It's not my problem. That, for them, it's not, you know, like, that's not my problem. You know what I mean? My problem is for me, it's disheartening.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, it's not, I, you know, I don't sit around and then go poop on someone's parade and say that, you know, your show really bummed me out. I mean, I may, you know, like, I generally just tend to walk, whatever, you know, I mean, there's, you might try to find out more about why somebody does something, then you can understand a little more, and then you figure out, oh, that is more interesting than I thought. But generally not. I mean, you know, generally it is either works or it doesn't for me, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You might know why some people do more things, and maybe then it makes it more complex and interesting, but...
And what does this say about your own work, I guess, is the question.
Just that I'm very harsh on it. I mean, or that, you know, reasonably, you know, like, I'm reasonably harsh on it. You know, like, in other words, I don't... there's a lot going on before even anything, you know, physical happens.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I mean, anybody can say that, I guess, but... I'm trying to like more art. I really would like to like more art because, I mean, I also feel like it's sort of...
Is this something, though, that has been your sensibility of all along? Or has it been more recent?
Yeah, pretty much all along.
So it's probably not going to change.
I think I can become more... I mean, I've already become more sociable, you know, over the years. I mean, you know, like a bit of 3-day weekend was also just a social tool to like literally... Sure. Literally make myself become more social and actually literally put myself in a position of being more social. And having kids starting about 9 or 10 years ago and, you know, all that has sort of taken me out of this, it's some level of going to openings all the time and being around this social milieu at a point where it didn't really matter so much in terms of my career on some level, but on like a long-term level, it probably does. So starting up 3-day weekend again and seeing a bunch of people and sort of having a reason to run into a lot of people didn't hurt me. I mean, I felt very good about that. I felt like, you know, I do have social skills and I actually can function on a level with people and I actually get something from it, you know what I mean? Whereas, you know, it's easy to get kind of like feeling slightly disenfranchised and be like, why am I putting myself out here for this shit?
Yeah.
You know, like the payback isn't really doing it. And I gotta admit, I'm on some levels a bit of a loner. You know, my wife tends to think I'm borderline autistic, but that's because she reads a book on autism. But, you know, it's if nothing else, it's allowed me to focus on certain things. But I do think that you, to be an artist, you have to be part of the world, and it doesn't hurt to be part of your own milieu just because you do learn from everybody, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
I'm working on it. So anyway, that's...
No, that's, I think you, that I help? Think you, that, yeah, that addresses, do you feel like...
The interesting thing to me is, you know, I think of a lot of these things, you know, like these paintings, also just physically stripe paintings, or like, you know, some almost like a level of field paintings on one level or another, you know, even though they're thin, you know, like this, and there's a lot more, I'm also just interested in color interplay and all that stuff, but then that makes me think they're not all so radically different than this, other than they're not overt with their sort of content.
You're talking about the...
Yeah, this other show that you're talking about.
Yeah.
So I just wonder, like, you know, like, how does that, like, I guess what I was trying to postulate in some of the spec, you know, is sort of like, it's not that different, you know, in some respects, but a lot of people did think it was, you know what I mean? And it, you know, there's a lot of reasons to think that, you know, there was that. And I'm just interested in figuring out, like, you know, like, part of it might be that, is I did another show that somewhat of this ilk in Belgium, like, you know, 3-4 months later, and, it, you know, it kind of went over like a lead balloon. And I just, you know, like, it makes me wonder, like, a lot of things. The way I thought about it was, like, you know, well, you know, when you're driving, there's a reason why there's certain traffic laws, and there's certain reason, you know, like, it's just people don't know what you're doing. So even if you're driving, you know, there's certain series of rules you follow so that, like, because people don't know what you're doing, they don't think you're doing wrong things, or, you know, like, you don't stop really fast, even though you don't, you know, technically a stop sign, you could either, you know, you can drift into a stop sign or you can just hit it really hard and stop. You could skid as much as you want, mm-hmm. scare the bejesus out of people, but you stopped, right? Right? You stopped, you know, like, so you didn't break any laws, but there's like social laws that you scared, someone pissed his pants in front of you because he thought you were going to run into him. You know, someone, and whatever, there's all sorts of various other things that are sort of uncouth about that in some, you know, on some level. And I wonder, with that kind of work, if that's some of what I'm doing.
Your metaphors are fascinating. I mean, I, you know, it's interesting to think of one's work or your work specifically as, you know, being like.
Am I jarring? You know, I'm making jarring turns that like scare the person in the seat next to me, even though we're not. I know we're not going to crash.
Did you get that sense from the reaction in Belgium?
On some level, yeah.
Yeah.
On some level, more like, you don't get that, you know, this is more like from hearing what the gallerist thought, sure, you know, and so on and so forth later. And then I also, you know, on some level, also realize how sort of trapped I am with a recognizable sort of thing. You know, it's like you start doing things that are off somewhere where you've gotten a lot of, like, play with this, that people, you know, the weird part is they want different things from you, but not too different, or they want things different, but different in the same way, or something like that. And I haven't figured that one out yet exactly. And my, you know, the way I can think about that is literally, you know, I've got to figure out, like, I don't want to, like, in some respects, I got to figure out how not to scare people, but then it seems like, why should I pussyfoot either, you know? You know, there's a lot of these that are still sitting in storage somewhere. And, you know, they're not cheap to store. They're 10 feet by 5 feet. I mean, it's like...
Oh, you mean... Physically, they're, yeah. They're in your storage.
Not in my storage, but, you know, like, in my gallery storage.
Mm.
And no one's yelling at me about it, but, I mean, it's just like... You know, I mean, I guess part of that, you know, you just do the thing where you keep them around for 10 years and then pull them out, and everyone's like, whoa! You know, if you're lucky. But, I mean, you know, it's like, then, you know, it's like, but until then, whatever, you know, it's... There was a number of, you know, things I thought about, but those were, like, the things I was thinking about in that, like, sort of, like, you know, some version, some weird version of automatic writing, some weird, you know, some version of, you know, something like automatic writing combined with sort of, you know, like, field painting or something like that done in a very precise manner.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, something as arbitrary as, like, the Tom Friedman, you know, stare at something for 1,000 hours, you know, piece or something.
Yeah.
Honestly, think of these pieces that I do, which are, like, you know, the radio station pieces, as being, I mean, those ones, when they're installed in a real space, actually have radios that it's transmitting off of, like, a little USB FM transmitter. So it's passing through space, so it's like a sculpture. It's also, and what it's playing is, like, my entire like, MP3 collection. So in a weird way, once again, if you are what you eat. And there's a book that goes with it that's a list of everything that could be in there.
Right.
And people get to write in the book whatever they want. You know, like, it's just like a sort of like equivalent of a sign-in book.
Right.
So it's kind of like an interesting, you know, that I think of that as like a big field. You know, it's like really all it is a long-lasting changing field that, you know, like is in a weird way like everything I might listen to. You know, at that time, whenever I, you know, chose to put it there. And so I feel that's like a field, you know, like a field. And I feel like these are like fields, you know, like they're just different versions of fields.
Do you have a sense now of what music or song you might want to use for the intro to this conversation?
Yeah, I figured I'd try to record something myself for it.
Great.
Yeah. I mean, okay. I already have at least one record that I mean, I have, like, MP3s of things I've recorded before.
Mm-hmm.
I want to, like, another record I want to do, which is, you know, you always, like, you start a record company, eventually you're going to do your own music. But I wasn't thinking about that when I started. There's two songs that we did with... that we did a long time ago. Mike had a group together for a little while with myself, Cameron, Jamie, Steve Prina, and Art Byington. And some of that we put out with Paul McCarthy, but Steve Prina wasn't a part of this other group called The Gobbler, and there's a CD of that we put out that has, like, some things with Paul McCarthy in his studio and then another live show that we did with Cameron, Jamie, myself, and Art and Mike. There was a live show we did at some place in Silver Lake. And he wanted to learn two songs that we never did that were both hymns. One's called There Is a Balm in Gilead, which is a lot of jazz people have done. Which goes like, there is a balm in Gilead. And then there was another one called Let All Mortal Flesh Stay Silent, which is another hymn. But I kind of like the idea of playing those two as two sides of a record. And so I've been starting to practice those, and I found the sheet music online. They're both very simple, and the whole idea would be they'd be kind of like just something simple to start with, and then you'd kind of do something with them. And I haven't figured out what to do with them yet, so in other words, that's just a matter of doing it for a while. But I kind of think they wouldn't be so bad to do either that or something else on trumpet or something just as for fun. I mean, I could always pick some other music. I never know. Like, once again, it really does matter. Like, I mean, I wouldn't treat what I do that different than all the other stuff that's around. If that makes any sense. I mean, it's how I deal with 3-day weekend generally and everything else, even though I am playing as the home team. I try not to really give myself any more of a idea than other people. You know, as much as I can treat my own work as a ready-made, you know, like as the records are sort of for doing things. If it fits, it fits. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
Sounds good. Are you good?
I'm good.
Thank you for talking to me.
Pleasure.
And we're out.